This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow, Pittsburgh hosts the Pats. The Falcons play in Philly, a circumstance that has provoked a rumor. But it's silly to think that if the Eagles win and if the Steelers roll, they'll call the big game 2 weeks hence the Pennsylvania Bowl. Joining me now to confirm that the Super Bowl will remain the Super Bowl no matter which two teams play in it is Paul Attner, who writes about football for the Sporting News. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Bill. I wish this was television, because right now you could see me trying out my winter attire here. I've got my coat on, my
boots, my
gloves, all the stuff for the 20 degrees or less weather in both places, and the wind chill factor supposedly of zero. Now, this is football weather, Bill, right?
Well, it is, but you bring up a wonderfully ironic point. Four teams will play in freezing temperatures for the right to play in beautiful temperature.
Yeah, although the beautiful temperature in Jacksonville, I guess this time of year could be in the 40s at game time, but that's still better than what we're going to see. These games are going to be played in a really miserable situation, even if it's not snowing. When you have wind chill factors around zero, that kind of wind and 19 degrees at kickoff, which I think is going to be in Pittsburgh, it does not set up for the kind of really quality games we should expect from these four teams, because these are really great matchups. But unfortunately, I think that, you know, the playing games in the Northeast this time of year, you run into these possibilities. It's kind of a shame.
Well, you talked about great matchups. Let's start by talking a little bit about the Atlanta Falcons, led by quarterback Michael Vick. He's known as a running quarterback. Everybody knows what he's going to do. If everybody knows what he's going to do, how come nobody can stop him?
Well, you know, because they don't have kryptonite. they need to develop some anecdote to stop Superman, and he is Superman. He made a touchdown run the end of the season against the Carolina Panthers, where he took off from the 10-yard line, and it was in the air the whole way, and got in the end zone before his knees touched on the 2-yard line. It was one of those Jordan-esque type taking off from the free throw line and dunking, and he's capable of doing those things, Bill, that nobody else has ever been able to do in football. Certainly no quarterback. You know, he can't throw nearly as well as the great quarterbacks, but his running ability, he's faster than any halfback in the league in the open field, and to give him a head start out of the backfield with that speed makes it virtually impossible to defend him.
If you have no allegiance to either the Atlanta Falcons or the Philadelphia Eagles, you sort of have to hope the Eagles win, don't you? I mean, three consecutive trips to the NFC Championship and nothing to show for it?
Yeah, well, I kind of hope for that almost, because I'm going to be there, and I don't want to see what the city of Philadelphia will do to its city when it's over if they lose. So they have been through so much and so much promise that has turned into failure for a variety of reasons, including injury. But I think they are good enough. I really do. I think Dunham McNabb, their quarterback, has matured enough to finally be ready. He's played just terribly in the three previous NFC Championship games, Bill, but this one, I just think he's much more prepared to give the kind of effort that they need to win.
The Patriots, meanwhile, almost completely shut down the league's most valuable player last week, holding Peyton Manning's Colts to 3 points and never trailing in that game. The Steelers, on the other hand, needed a good bounce and overtime to beat the Jets. Do these contrasting circumstances have any bearing on the game in Pittsburgh?
Well, probably not. I mean, the Steelers are living on house money right now. I mean, they should be dead and gone. I mean, they shouldn't be in this game. But regardless, they are in the game, and they're playing at home, and where they are very difficult to beat. And they've beaten the Patriots quite handily earlier in the season, not even a close game, and I'm sure that gives them confidence. But based on what I saw last weekend, the Patriots are a better team, and they have all that playoff experience, and they have Tom Brady. And let's never underestimate Tom Brady. Peyton Manning had all the stats, and Brady has another win under his belt, and Manning's home, because Brady just is a great pressure quarterback.
All right, you seem to have been saying that Donovan McNabb would be enough and that the Eagles would beat the Falcons. I cannot extract from your comments about the Steelers-Pats game which team you think will win. Give me a pick there.
Well, I made the mistake, and I will admit, of picking against Bill Belichick last week. I thought the Colts were going to win, and I was wrong, and I've learned my lesson, and I'm never going to – I think the rest of his existence in New England, I will never pick against the Patriots again, Bill. And we're on record now, so we can, you know, we can play it again. I will say that the Patriots not only are going to win this one, but I think they'll go on to win the Super Bowl too.
The Super Bowl, of course, will occur on February the 6th, meaning that you've got 2 weeks to fill with copies, starting on Sunday night. Tell me about your preparation, Paul.
I've been trying not to think about that, but it's amazing that it's better game with the 2 week rest. There's no question. I think the quality of the game is better, and I think it does allow for the better team to emerge because it gives the proper preparation for a game this big. But for us, it's a nightmare. I mean, you know, and I'm sure the listenership out there isn't very sympathetic. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff to write, and you feel like you're running out of story situations and ideas by the end of next week, much less you know, the days before the Super Bowl. But again, that's a minor problem compared to the fact that I think we do get a much better game with a 2 week rest.
You haven't got the names of the peewee coaches of all the pertinent quarterbacks in your Rolodex already?
No, I've got them for the third string tackle. So you got to have every angle covered here.
Paul Attner writes about the National Football League for the Sporting News. Paul, thanks as always, and don't forget that those guys who coach the Super Bowlers back when they were mutant peewees have great insights.
Well, they do, and they've taught all these guys the lessons they never forgot. Remember that.
The Orlando Magic are currently 21-17, and despite ongoing questions about Grant Hill's health, they seem ready to make the NBA playoffs after a miserable 21-61 campaign last season. Only a game's Gabe O'Connor has more.
Here's a redundant exercise in understatement. The 2003-2004 Orlando Magic were a mess. The team won their season opener and then promptly lost their next 19. Coach Doc Rivers was fired after 11 games. Magic management may have done him a favor. The team finished with a league-worst 21-61 record, and Orlando had one of the most demoralized locker rooms in the league. When the season ended, the ownership blew the team up. General manager John Gabriel lost his job, and through trades, free agent signings, and the draft, the Magic completely revamped their roster. Orlando added 11 new players while subtracting unhappy superstar Tracy McGrady. McGrady was the league's scoring champion, but his growing frustration with the mounting losses was a source of angst on a team that hardly needed more. So McGrady was sent to Houston this summer in a 7-player deal that brought All-Star guard Steve Francis and 2 other players to Orlando. Forward Pat Garrity, one of just 4 holdovers from last season, says the Magic needed a fresh start.
When you have a year like that, the best way to do it is just to make personnel moves to bring in guys who weren't involved with that don't have memories or grudges or agendas relating to some prior experience, and it's just to rebuild on a positive note.
The change has been positive so far. The Magic are 4 games over 500, and if the playoffs started today, they would include Orlando. Observers suspected the Magic couldn't be worse, but few thought the team would have already matched last year's victory total by now. Before a recent game against the Celtics in Boston's Fleet Center, the newly acquired Francis said his team is actually underachieving.
Honestly, I expected better, but I knew it was going to take, it's going to, and we're still not 100% adjusted to each other's game. You know, we have so many new players. You know, I expect us to improve as the season progresses. I don't think that we're at our peak, and I think it's a good time not to be at your peak.
Fortunately for the Magic, they play in the weak Eastern Conference where teams don't have to peak, ever, to make the finals. There's plenty of time for the new players to gel. However, the key to Orlando's remarkable turnaround may be a player they've had for several years. Forward Grant Hill, a 5-time All-Star with the Detroit Pistons, signed a lucrative contract with the Magic in 2000. Then 28, Hill was supposed to bring the Magic back to the NBA Finals for the first time since 1995. Instead, he severely injured his ankle, and so began a painful 4-year journey of rehab and re-injury and rehab again. Now 32, Hill is coming off his 4th major ankle surgery. Few expected him to play again, much less be productive. However, Hill has surprised almost everyone by averaging nearly 20 points a game. Hill thinks his ankle woes are finally behind him, but he knows that fans can't help anticipating the next injury.
If it wasn't my ankle, I'd probably feel the same way. You know, ultimately, the more I play, the more games I put together of health and out there on the court, the less people remember, I guess, and the less cynical and the less skeptical people will become. And probably deep down subconsciously, the less skeptical I'll become. You know, I'm sure there still is a little bit of unknown or fear or what have you. That's just part of it, you know. But I try to go out there and play and be aggressive and do what I've always done.
Doc Rivers never knew what it was like to coach Grant Hill for an entire season. Every year, that hope died when Hill limped off the court. His feelings for Orlando may have soured after last year's disaster, but he has not soured on Grant Hill.
He is everything that sports needs. There's not a bad thing about the guy, you know, his attire. That's it. You know, if he dressed better, then everything would be good about him. But besides that, I mean, the guy is an art collector. I wish he was single and my daughter was older.
Rivers now coaches the Boston Celtics. His team's 119-101 victory over the Magic earlier this month proved Orlando still has more work to do, especially on defense. And Hill still has injuries. His repaired ankle is fine, but a bruised shin and wrist have been bothersome for the past couple of weeks. An MRI on the wrist this week came up negative. However, the Magic are positive their playoff hopes are almost gone without a 100% Hill in the lineup. Steve Francis was blunt about the idea of playing without a healthy Hill.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know, honestly.
For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Apparently hoping to get some mileage out of a Vatican connection, Formula One champion Michael Schumacher and the rest of the Ferrari racing team met with the Pope early this week. After the Ferrari team presented Pope John with a small model car, Ferrari president Luca di Montezemolo remarked, "It is the first time that one of our cars has entered the Vatican." Mr. di Montezemolo said he wanted to honor the Pope because of his, quote, courage and defense of human rights that had put him in the pole position on the roads of humanity. The Pope, who rode in a full-sized Ferrari when he visited the carmaker's plant in 1988, told the group, quote, that sports is important for all society. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a new documentary film introduces some proud and resilient swimmers. But first, the members of the U.S. men's soccer team are not thrilled with a new contract the U.S. Soccer Federation has offered them. As a result, they aren't in camp, and the Federation has begun training replacements, players with no international experience. The Federation says it is prepared to enter the next round of World Cup qualifying, which begins with a match against Trinidad and Tobago on February 9th, with the replacement players. Joining me now from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to evaluate these circumstances is ESPN soccer commentator Seamus Mallon. Seamus, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from San Jose is former national team player Alexi Lalas, who is now the general manager of Major League Soccer's San Jose Earthquakes. Alexi, welcome back to Only a Game.
Gentlemen, pleasure.
Seamus, the players have been without a contract for more than 2 years. Is that simply because they don't feel they're being paid enough?
What player ever acknowledges that he's paid enough, you know? Well, it's, you know, I think there are a lot of issues here, obviously. And there are times when I say to you, Bill, I'm so sorry that I don't go to bed every night twisting and turning about the latest machinations between Federation and players because life is too short. Mm. It reminds me of what Henry Kissinger once said about academic departmental disputes. He says, why do people get so angry? And the answer is because the stakes are so low. And they're in the pantheon of American sports, the stakes look really quite lower than the average. But on the other hand, for the players, they mean a lot. I mean, this is a team that has really done a fabulous job. They've caught the attention of the fans. The fans want them to do well. There's high expectation, and there's no reason why they shouldn't understandably be capitalizing on that. The Federation's story is a little harder to parse out and a little harder to feel sympathy for, but maybe Alexei does.
Alexei, some people are going to look at the current situation and say, Trinidad and Tobago, heck, the replacement players ought to be able to handle them, so who cares if the first stringers aren't available? Would they be right?
Well, I mean, that's perception out there. I mean, we've done very, very well and obviously gotten to World Cups many years in a row now. But when you're playing in CONCACAF, which is the region that we play in, there's more teams that come out. But you have to go to these places, and it's a very, very difficult situation. So to drop your first game and lose out on those points, we still could qualify. It's very difficult to go in there, and I'd hate to at least start off with a loss that you had absolutely no opportunity to even gain a win.
Let me add something here, too. I think, you know, there's also a little bit of history here. Trinidad and Tobago, of course, we all remember the great Paul Caligiuri goal in 89 that got us to the World Cup in 90, and the U.S. finally started to come back onto the world scene, and it's been good progress pretty much ever since, with occasional bumps along the way. But I think, Trinidad and Tobago will see this as an opportunity for them to get a quick leap ahead. If we send an A-League team down there, that's what concerns me. And it will be an inspiration for them to go out and try to get that 3 points, because realistically the only thing we would hope for would be to get a draw, get a point. And to go down there and win with an A-League team is really, really asking a lot. In fact, Alexei, you may want to think about this. If the team went down there as an A-League team, sort of, if you will, semi-professionals, got a result, people might start to say, well, how good is MLS?
I think that goes into the calculation, and I think it goes into what's happened over the past 10 years. We've created this league, but we've also created a tremendous amount of depth. Now, the fans that we've created want to see the best, and they want to see the stars, and they want us to have every opportunity to get to that World Cup. And for people that remember back in 1994, what a World Cup does to a culture and to a country, we want to have that opportunity as many times as possible. As you said, there's been bumps along the way, and we've learned from those lessons. And would we recover from not going to a World Cup? But it would be very difficult, and it would be an incredible sore point and a very difficult thing to have to go from there.
Seamus, the Players Association released a statement Thursday that said the players would continue to, quote, pursue all options to open camp in time for the first choice team to face Trinidad and Tobago on February the 9th. At this point, what options are there?
Well, good question. You know, their players, of course, are playing Europe. When you look at now the number of Americans who are playing overseas, but apart from those guys, there still are domestic-based players who are very, very, very important to the nucleus of this side, and that's why MLS has been so tremendously significant in the development of American players, and that has allowed us at times to put out virtually all MLS teams to go on and take on some very good teams. So there is depth there, but there's also the preparation is absolutely crucial, and slapped together at the last minute is a formula for a mini disaster.
Alexei, you want to offer some quote-unquote options that might be pursued at the table at this point that would get the best possible team on the field on February 9th?
You know, I think first and foremost, it's a willingness to negotiate and a willingness to understand that regardless, everybody has to give a little. I think the players understand that. I hope that the Federation understands that. They are, as Seamus said, in the greater scheme of things, we are soccer, and we recognize our position in terms of the sporting landscape, and they want to find a fair and equitable solution. I believe that if the representation of both the players and the Federation is in a room, locked in a room, and I'll keep the key so they can't come out, that we can find a way to resolve this situation and get what everybody wants, and that is the best possible team on the field qualifying for yet another World Cup and continuing with the efforts to promote the game of soccer that exists not only with the national team but also with MLS and right on down to the kids that play when they're 8 and 9 years old.
Alexei Lalas, who played in every minute of every U.S. match at the 94 World Cup, is a veteran of four MLS teams. He's now the general manager of the San Jose Earthquakes. Alexei, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And Seamus Mallon is a soccer analyst for ESPN. Seamus, a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. So, you want to catch up on your sports movies. Coach Carter, currently the number one box office draw in the land, stars Samuel L. Jackson as the controversial high school basketball coach Ken Carter, who made national news a few years ago by benching his undefeated basketball team for poor academic performance. You can also check out Buzz Bissinger's story of the 1988 Permian High Panthers of Odessa, Texas, because Friday Night Lights is now available on DVD. Or you can check out Watermarks, a new documentary about the Jewish athletes who dominated competitive swimming in Austria in the 1920s and 1930s. From New York, John Kalish reports.
Hakoach is Hebrew for the strength. And Israeli-born filmmaker Yaron Zilberman says that's what the girls of the Hakoach Vienna Sports Club needed when confronted with a hatred directed at them by their pro-Nazi rivals, the First Viennese Sports Club. Jews were barred from Austrian athletics by the notorious Aryan paragraph, which applied to social, religious, and political activities. By the mid-1930s, violent anti-Semitic demonstrations were breaking out at athletic competitions.
When you imagine these young girls competing and facing all this hatred, I found that, like, amazing. This is, for me, courage. Because men, we're already accustomed to, you know, men's courageous stories. But women at such age, making such decisions on their own, I thought is really inspiring.
Zilberman met a Jewish swimmer named Renee Mittler, who got a taste of that hatred after jumping off a bridge into the Danube River for a race.
She dives and she says, I didn't look at anything, just swim fast, you know, one more stroke, one more, fast, very, very fast. And at some point she looked back and she doesn't see anybody. She's like so far away, beating everybody with such a huge distance. Then it was incredible. But when she arrived and she went out of the water and they saw the Star of David on her chest, then the crowd started to be very angry and actually running after her. So the coach took her, they got into a car and they escaped. They didn't collect even the medal.
Anne-Marie Pisker now lives in London. She's one of the Hakoach girls who are now in their 80s and featured in Yaron Zilberman's new documentary, Watermarks.
You know, we were very much out to show Austria how good the Jewish sports people can be, because they always thought we never had any sort of history of sports. We had to show them that what they can do, we can do better.
These days, swimming isn't a sport that draws large crowds of spectators, but in pre-war Vienna, that wasn't the case.
In Austria, swimming was huge. I mean, soccer was bigger. That's the biggest always in European countries. But swimming was huge. And just as an example, in the Danube, like there was an annual 7-kilometer grueling competition, 500,000 people used to gather just to see who's going to win. And Hakoach won like every year.
Judith Deutsch was one of Hakoach's greatest female swimmers. She held 12 national records in middle and long distance freestyle events. In 1936, she won the Golden Badge of Honor, one of Austria's most prestigious athletic awards. That same year, Deutsch, along with Hakoach swimmers Ruth Langer and Lucy Goldner, resigned from Austria's 1936 Olympic team.
It's very easy to go now, look back and say, oh, of course she said no to the Nazis. Yeah, everybody would say no to the Nazis. But that's not the case. And only for one reason, when she went to the Maccabiah Games, which is like a Jewish Olympics in 1935, she went to Palestine, and on the way on the ship, they were together with the German team. And the German swimming team already told Judith that in the swimming pool, there were signs saying, for dogs and Jews, the entrance is not allowed. And for her, that was unacceptable. And he said, if that's how the Jews are treated in Germany, I don't go to the Olympics.
After refusing to compete in the Berlin Olympics, Deutsch was banned from competition for life, and all her records were voided. When the Germans marched into Austria in 1938, Deutsch and her sister Hani were among the Hakoach athletes who escaped.
A few months ago, I joined the British Air Force. Here, I met a nice young airman, Jimmy. He is a Londoner, and we decided to get married. My sister Judith sends her love. Honey Deutsch, British Air Force, Egypt.
A total of 39 Hakoach athletes perished in concentration camps. The ones who left Austria started new lives on various continents. Anne-Marie Pisker arrived in London with two suitcases and just £5 in her pocket. Pisker told filmmaker Jeroen Zilberman he couldn't imagine what it was like to start a new life under such circumstances.
You have no idea. You have no idea what it means. You sink or you swim. And when you're young, you swim.
While Pisker started a new life in England, Judith Deutsch started hers in what would become the State of Israel. In 1995, some 60 years after her ban from Austrian athletic competition, Deutsch was contacted by the president of the Austrian Swimming Federation.
She gets a letter from Austria saying, "Dear Judy Deutsch, we just now realize what terrible thing we've done to you, and please, we want to invite you to Vienna, and, you know, in a ceremony, an official ceremony, we'll return all the medals to you, and we'll, you know, we put everything in place." And basically Judith says, you know, she calls them and she says, "If you want to give me the records back, now you have to come to Tel Aviv." And all the officials, you know, they pack their stuff and they came to Tel Aviv, and there was a big ceremony, a very nice one, and they returned all the medals back.
Deutsch was too ill to go to Vienna for the week-long HaKoach reunion in June 2002. She died in Israel 2 months ago at the age of 86. The Watermarks documentary closes with an emotional shot of the surviving HaKoach swimmers back in Vienna. They're wearing recreations of their old HaKoach swimsuits with a Jewish star displayed prominently on the chest. The film ends with the elderly women swimming out of the frame as the screen fades to black. Once again, filmmaker Jeroen Zilberman.
This is the victory scene, you know. This is a scene where they're victorious. I mean, Hitler died and the whole Nazi regime luckily disappeared. And look at them, they still swim, and not only they swim together as a team in their old swimming pool, in their old bathing suits, in Vienna. I mean, what's more victory than that?
The documentary Watermarks began its theatrical run in New York last night. In the coming weeks, it'll be shown in several cities, including Miami, Boston, Kansas City, and Baltimore. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
You're listening to Only a Game. Regarding the current circumstances of the National Hockey League, at least one Only a Game listener believes that, quote, hockey shouldn't be brought back until they make it a more wide-open, fast-moving game. So opines Dennis Sandelman, who hears the show via onlyagame.org. He went on to write, "Major rule changes are needed before hockey becomes as low-scoring as soccer." Jane Derland, a Boston resident who reads at least one out-of-town paper, emailed to say, "Congratulations on being a clue in the New York Times crossword puzzle. I guess that means you've really hit the big time. Your wide range of subject matter and insightful commentary keep Only a Game several cuts above any other sports show. Charlie Pierce is good, too, but see if you can get him to cut down on the caffeine." Ms. Derland, I'm glad you got 45 down that day in the Times puzzle, and I hope we didn't stump too many people. Lynn Portnoy, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, wrote to say that she thinks National Public Radio is, quote, wrong to air Only a Game, and to suggest that the program is only on because it is, quote, a sop to the right. I don't think I'll run that letter by Charlie. Hugh Ortman, who hears Only a Game on WILL in Urbana, Illinois, wrote to suggest that we change the name of the program to Only a Game if it happens on one of the coasts, preferably the east one and more particularly the northeast. He closed his email by expressing his disappointment that, quote, you are not an alternative sports program, but merely a regionally biased one. Finally, Rob Meltzer, a WBUR listener who's been following developments in baseball's campaign against steroids, wrote, "What business is it of Congress or Major League Baseball what professional ballplayers do with their time or their bodies? So long as they perform their contractual obligation of making loads of money for the team owners, what's wrong with performance-enhancing drugs?" You can answer that question or another one, say 45 down, or ask one if you like. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us directly through our website, onlyagame.org. Our mailing address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, California hockey players are on a roll. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me on the line from Milwaukee. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell is doing some rescheduling this week. It seems that he has a budget address scheduled for February 8th, which would be the likely day for a post-Super Bowl celebration. Given that the state has two teams in the conference finals, sound like a wise move?
Well, I think he should make the contingency plans, but I think probably only one of his teams is going to be there.
Uh-oh. Which one?
I think that the Philadelphias will be there, but I don't think the Pittsburghs will be there.
Now, what happens if both the Philadelphias and the Pittsburghs are there? What does the governor bet against himself?
Well, apparently the governors are then taken out of the equation. This is a bet that's made only on the mayoral level.
I get it.
I haven't checked the Pennsylvania State Constitution recently, but I think in this situation it's forced to be on the mayoral level.
More to the point, who wins the ever more complex TV advertising battle between the Budweisers and the Millers, currently being staged during timeouts and at halftime on a television near you?
Well, remember where I'm calling you from. And I'm calling you from a city where we speak derisively of what is known as St. Louis Kool-Aid. So I'm going to go with the Miller people, even though it's not made here either. It at least has its roots here.
In my favorite football story of the week, the winner in the 9-year-old division of the punt, pass, and kick competition was a refugee from Nigeria who, according to his coach, quote, doesn't care much for football. Do you think he'll get a D1 scholarship offer anyway?
Well, I don't know, but he certainly cares about punting and passing and kicking. Perhaps he doesn't care about the blocking and tackling and being knocked over part.
That's probably exactly right.
It's your kind of football, Bill.
Absolutely. I love it. The NHL and the NHL Players Association met this week to try to resolve the 4-month lockout, but they left Commissioner Gary Bettman and Union Chief Bob Goodenow at home. I know these sort of lower-level negotiations are not exactly unusual. They happen all the time. But isn't the point usually to keep them secret?
I think both sides are demonstrating to the fans who they don't care about that they actually care about them. And we're making our good faith effort. Maybe it's just these two guys who happen to be the guys in charge of everything who are getting in the way.
By the way, for the record, the results of these lower-level meetings, nil. Nothing.
Fairly well mirrored the results of the upper-level meetings.
Right. In basketball news, LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers scored 27 points, grabbed 11 rebounds, and accumulated 10 assists on Wednesday night against the Trailblazers, thus becoming the youngest NBA player to accomplish a triple-double. So here's your trivia question of the day. Who previously held that distinction?
Oh, the youngest NBA player to do a triple-double?
Yep.
Oscar Robertson probably did it his first NBA game. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know if you're wrong about Oscar Robertson, but he was not the youngest. The youngest, remarkably enough, was Lamar Odom.
Well, that's interesting. But, as you know, the triple-double, if one always has to remember the triple-doubles, is that Oscar Robertson averaged a triple-double one year.
That's right.
And I'm always struck when people make triple-double remarks. Reminds me of the great Bobby Bonds line about being a 40-40 man. If I'd known it was a big deal, I'd have done it more often.
Absolutely. The new Chicago Bulls managed a 7-game winning streak before losing to Boston earlier this week. So we get a signal there of the return to the halcyon days of Jordan Pippen et al.?
Well, I don't know, but I think most of the Chicago lineup is now capable of buying a beer on its own. I mean, we've all reached the age of consent pretty much. Kirk Heinrich, the little point guard from Kansas, is starting to round into shape. They're an interesting team. And they're very exemplary of what I think is the coming renaissance in the NBA. They play very well and very entertainingly, and they score, you know, in the triple digits occasionally.
Roger Clemens will pitch at least one more year for the Houston Astros. They'll pay him $18 million to do it, more than any other pitcher will make next summer. The salary is, I suppose, based on experience. Clemens is, after all, 42.
He knows more about pitching than most folks. But on so many different levels, including the ability to cash in, you've got to give Roger Clemens an enormous amount of credit. I don't think you'll ever see another contract for an athlete in a team sport over the age of 40 like this one ever again.
Though they lost their bid to bring the Expos to Northern Virginia, the Virginia Baseball Stadium Authority announced this week that they would stay in business. Do you suppose they figure the Washington deal still somehow won't work out?
Well, I figure they've got a lease on some nice office space in Arlington, and they just don't want to give it up. I mean, it's at a premium. No, I mean, if given the history of the Montreal Expos and the way this whole thing in Washington has worked out, you'd be dumb to go out of business if you were the Northern Virginia Stadium Association. Once you printed up the letterhead.
Even post-opening day, anything could happen.
I think you keep this open at least until the All-Star break.
Speaking of the Expos, the team will apparently not be bringing the Montreal mascot, Yuppie, to Washington.
Oh, no!
Yeah, Yuppie is in fact for sale. So what team might benefit from acquiring a huge orange creature of indeterminate species?
Well, I think there's no question that Yuppie should now go to work for the hockey team at the University of Northern Michigan, which does, after all, play on the Yuppie.
Hey, I love it. Meanwhile, the Florida Marlins are apparently fooling around with the idea of becoming the Las Vegas Marlins. I wasn't aware that Marlins swam in the waters of Lake Mead.
No Marlins in Vegas, but lots of sharks. Hey, everyone,
oh,
a Maserati.
Very good. Where's that drum roll when we need it? After receiving a grand total of 9 complaints, the FCC is investigating NBC's August broadcast of the Athens Olympics opening ceremonies because they included actors portraying nude Greek sculptures. This week, the Athens Olympic chief asked the FCC not to punish NBC, saying that such a move would, quote, bring about a closed-minded fortress mentality. Fortress-minded mentality. Here?
And Michael Powell, who I'm sure was hired after a nationwide search, you know, the best person qualified to be the job happened to be the Secretary of State's kid, is leaving office. So these protests will at least briefly fall on deaf ears. 9 complaints?
9. Count them.
Were they all from, like, the same household?
Well, the handwriting was the same on all of them.
Look, Mother, there are naked people.
Yesterday, the United States Anti-Doping Agency announced that curler Mitchell Marks had received a 2-year suspension for refusing to take an out-of-competition drug test last October. Have we got a developing curling scandal on our hands?
Oh, Bill, no. What will we tell the children? I guess you could say this gentleman has been broomed from his sport, though.
I guess so. Swept away. What benefit?
Exactly what performance is being enhanced by this?
That was going to be my question. What do you become? A quicker sweeper?
There's no advantage to being able to throw the stone faster, right?
Or harder. You don't want it to hit the wall.
Maybe it's the vigorous brooming.
Yeah, I think we've guaranteed we'll get at least 9 letters from curling fans this week.
Or maybe this guy is just innocent and wants to tell the dope police to go, you know, climb a tree, in which case I'm on his side.
Finally, Charlie, there is news this week that Pop Warner football players in Marlboro, Massachusetts, were benched last season for failing to raise $250 each in support of the league. Heck, the NFL can't require its players to do that, can it?
I don't believe so, but I think we found a solution to the corruption in college football. Make them earn all the money they want as long as they kick back a big piece of it.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game and even helps us raise funds from time to time. I shouldn't probably have mentioned that. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.vu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. According to the Hockey News, National Hockey League Players Association President Trevor Linden has told his fellow players to prepare for a lockout that lasts well into next season. There are no future talks planned, and a formal cancellation of the 2004-2005 NHL season is expected to come soon. If the NHL ever does get the Zambonis rolling again, the league might find future talent coming from an unexpected source. From Irvine, California, Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
At 5 years old, Luke is already learning the essence of hockey. He zips around the rink in safety equipment that weighs as much as he does, delights in putting the biscuit in the basket, and, according to his coaches, he leads the league in penalty minutes. Luke has also learned a little something about team loyalty.
Hey, did you tell Karen what you say about the Ducks?
What do you say about the Ducks?
Ducks suck.
He's not a Ducks fan.
Not a Ducks fan. No. Who are you a fan of?
Kings.
The Kings. Do you want to play for the Kings someday?
Yeah.
If Luke does manage to play for the Kings someday, it will not be by following the path of Wayne Gretzky and other greats from the frozen north. Luke lives in Southern California, and if he makes it to the big time, it will be because he's spent most of his time in rollerblades, not ice skates. He's following the example of Tori DiRoberto, who ironically recently retired from playing for those aforementioned Anaheim Mighty Ducks.
I grew up out here in Southern California, played back in the day before Gretzky was traded here to Los Angeles. There was probably three or four rinks around, so found myself, my dad, driving, 3 hours just to go to a hockey practice. So back in the day, the roller hockey, it was easy to play out in the street, and, you could practice that way. So I'd say 85% of the time I spent on rollerblades.
Today, DiRoberto is a coach for the MPC Bulls, a developmental program at the California Roller Hockey Center in Irvine. Ice rinks in California are more plentiful than when DiRoberto was young, but he still sees an advantage for kids who get their start on wheels.
Some of these kids are doing moves that I probably couldn't even do, and that's just because it's similar to basketball, where they can go home and play for 6 or 7 hours out in their street. And with ice hockey, you get an hour of practice a week, and that's all you get. So these kids are playing all day, every day, and you just see the development of their skill level just, really surpass the ice kids.
Over the years, the game of roller hockey has taken plenty of abuse from its icebound cousin. Even Bulls general manager and former Hartford Whaler Doug Jones admits he didn't think much of roller hockey when he was first introduced to the game.
No, I didn't. I have to admit, for me to sit here right now, my hypocrisy goes so far, right, I guess. It's just I sat there and went, what are they doing? Being an ice hockey purist, there was just no comparison between the two.
Since then, Jones has become a convert. Sure, players have to adjust to skating on ice, but roller hockey, with five to a side, develops skaters who are faster, see the floor better, and are more creative. Jones says even NHL scouts are starting to take notice.
If we were sit here 15 years ago and talk about California ice hockey players, people would laugh and go, California, there's nobody out of... But you look at Torrey... There's players like Noah Clark, you've got Justin Morrison, you've got all these kids that are now being drafted by NHL teams that got their start in roller hockey, and they were roller hockey players first.
The three rinks of the California Roller Hockey Center are home to dozens of teams, from the over-the-hill recreational players to high school varsity teams to younger kids who just want to play for fun. But for the roughly 180 kids in the MPC Bulls developmental program, roller hockey is serious business. As Doug Jones lectures the players on the finer points of the three-point stance, head coach Nick Moran clips a small parachute to one player's belt and makes him skate in tight circles until his legs burn and his chest heaves. Players must attend two practices every week, mandatory training camps, and weekend travel tournaments. It's a big commitment, especially for parents like Carol Ann Monahan, whose son Cameron plays on two teams.
He would love to make something out of it, but he's pretty realistic. He no longer wants to be the NHL star, but it occupies about five nights of our week. Luckily, the family really enjoys it.
You would have to.
Mm-hmm.
You would have
to. Yeah, my house is a mess, They don't get a home-cooked meal much, but we live on pretzels at the rink.
Cameron is a first-year bantam, which means he's 15 years old. Monahan says hockey's unique age ranking system has led to more than one awkward conversation with Southern California's hockey neophytes.
It's really funny to try to explain that to his non-hockey friends. What do you mean a peewee is bigger than a squirt and, you know, a midget? You play with a bunch of midgets. That's really good, you know.
So can you tell me how the divisions go? Like, how do they...
Adam? Well, actually, there's a newer division called Cubs. It'll go Cubs, Adams, Mites, Squirts, Peewees, Bantams, Midgets, Juniors.
Good, good. Angel, very nice. Good job. There we go. Square up. Get set.
On the other side of the facility, Carol Taylor watches her 18-year-old daughter, Lindsay, practice with her high school varsity team. Taylor also had a lot to learn about roller hockey when Lindsay and her 15-year-old sister, Sarah, started skating 7 years ago. They've recently picked up ice hockey as well, but they can't be convinced to give up their old favorite.
They love it. They love it. They used to spend about 5 days a week playing hockey in roller hockey. Now it's probably 3 to 4 days in ice and a couple of days of roller. So we're one rink or the other probably at least 6 days a week.
When Bulls coaches told the family the girls could net prime college scholarships if they took to the ice, they packed their bags and went to Huntington Beach to try out for Cal Selects, a girls' travel team that's won one national championship, produced 3 United States national team members, and filled 22 Division I roster spots.
Roller had given them an excellent start into ice hockey. They went over there. They were the only 2 girls that were picked up out of the girls that tried out for the ice team, which was something to be said. And the teams that they play on are very competitive back east, which everybody's very surprised how well they do. You know, there's a California, there's no hockey in California. Well, there is hockey in California, and the girls do quite well.
Doug Jones isn't surprised by the success of his players. He just wishes everyone else wasn't so surprised by it.
It'd be nice if somebody would just look at the comparison and say, you know, roller hockey is a very viable sport. It feeds and it helps develop a lot of the ice players. We want to be good to roller hockey, not treat roller hockey like it's, you know, the redheaded stepchild. So what I'd really like to see is somehow a partnership of the two.
As USA Hockey's inline program enters its second decade, semi-professional roller hockey leagues spring up around the country, and kids line up for high school and even college varsity teams, Jones thinks that day is coming. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Irvine, California.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. Special thanks to Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or check out the Rolling Hockey Players of California. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from MPC Bulls General Manager Doug Jones, who identifies himself thusly.
Good-looking guy, blonde hair, single, just turned 40.
Welcome to the Only a Game Singles Network, where you can find your dream roller hockey executive and more. Geez, I'm all for increasing female listenership, but this is ridiculous. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.